I'm waiting for the tape. I'm waiting for the tape. There it is. Okay. Once again, Paul Rodell here, and IVS Oral History Project, and today is Thursday, June 27th, and I'm in the home of Tom Tufts, who was for many years in Laos, 68 to 75, and a couple years in agriculture, and then 5 more years in education. So he's got a vast amount of experience and has already shared a monthly report. This is a photocopy, isn't it?
Right.
Okay, all right. Because I was wondering if I should return this to you.
No.
Or if, yeah, that was just a gift. Okay. First question for Tom, like for everyone else in advance of you, was something that we didn't have space for on the form. And something that is really very important. And that is something about you yourself, where and when you were born, your parents, you know, not just who they were by name, but who they were as people, that, and as parents of you, their child, Tom, you know, and how they affected you, how your church affected you, how your schools affected you, all toward the goal of you as a young adult deciding to commit yourself to joining this organization, or at least trying it out. And for that, I'll just open that up so that you can pick out for yourself what you think are your high points, rather than answering a specific questionnaire that might focus you in directions that you wouldn't necessarily choose for yourself. This way, I get to sit back and shut up.
You can take a nap.
Yeah.
I'll go
to the bathroom. I'll be right there.
I was born July 30th, 1940, in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I grew up living in Westchester County, outside of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
My father and mother had come to the East from Chicago. And my father was a business consultant. He worked in mostly in personnel in New York City. When I was in fifth grade, I went to a boarding school, a church boarding school in New York City, St. Thomas Church Choir School.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. 3 years. And that was quite a formative experience for me, broadened my view of the world.
Because you were away from home.
I was away from home. I commuted weekly.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd come home Sunday evening after Evensong, and
mm-hmm.
Then I'd go back Monday evening. And usually Monday evening I'd meet my father in the city, and
mm-hmm.
we'd see a movie or at least go to a restaurant. Usually we'd go to one from a different country every year.
Mm-hmm. Every year?
I mean, every week.
Oh, okay.
It's late.
They didn't let you go off.
Wait until it's 10:30. I went to private schools in private day school in Westchester County after I left the choir school. I left that as soon as my voice changed. You were there for the choir, and your voice changed, and you were out. I went to a preparatory school in New England, Hotchkiss, and in Lakeville, Connecticut. And from there, I went to Harvard for undergraduate career. I think I was the first person from that school to go to Harvard. Usually, nobody wanted to go to Harvard. They wanted to go to Yale.
Oh, really?
And the headmaster was fairly new at that time, and he wanted to send somebody to Harvard, so he picked me. I mean, I don't even remember applying to other places. I think it was all sort of arranged. I majored in English literature, and my freshman year in my sophomore year in college, my father died after an illness of 2 years, and I had 4 siblings, and I was the oldest male. I had one older sister.
Uh-huh.
So, we, at that time, my family was living in Cleveland. I drove them east, and we moved back to the East Coast to be closer to where my sister, older sister and I were in school. After I graduated from college, I went to the University of Illinois. I was there for 3 years and I got my master's and finished my coursework for a PhD and decided I was not interested in spending the rest of my life as I had spent the first part of my life in class.
Okay.
Especially without a break. I was 23.
Don't kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, so, you really zipped through that fast.
Yeah. Wow. And so that I was just like wasn't master- ready.
Yeah.
I wasn't ready to write a thesis and get my PhD and then start teaching college. I mean, I was teaching at the University of Illinois, but I wasn't ready to make a lifetime commitment. And about that time...
if I could stop you for a second, just to add in my two cents, I find that's really true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you said this is true for your case, but I saw this from other people who were along with me. You know, I returned after doing so many other things.
Yes, right.
And there was something about a visceral commitment that the others simply didn't lack, even though they were much smarter than I in some cases. Yeah. They just didn't have, you know, that goal, so they didn't have the dogged determinism when it came, you know, to facing a very long road.
Right.
You know, suddenly the longness of the road, the length of the road, really, you know, pops up in front of you. It becomes intimidating.
Right.
Yeah, sorry, you just kicked that off, but it's an interesting point, you know.
I looked around. I looked at social work, and I found I decided that was more like being a policeman than actually helping people. It was more monitoring and making sure people weren't cheating, and that didn't appeal to me.
And running people through bureaucracies and the like. Well, what were you... You said that you were an English Lit major, for that was at Harvard.
At Harvard and the University of Illinois.
That was the trajectory you were on.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
At the University of Illinois, also, I taught freshman English, and they have open admissions there, and they use the freshman English class to close the admissions. They
to weed out.
Fail out. Yeah. They weed out large... And that sort of turned me off a little bit, too. I thought about the Peace Corps. Oh, also, I was interested in American literature. And they said, well, the way to become a professor of American literature is to study Old Icelandic, Old English, and don't take any courses in American literature because you can always just read that on your own. This was 1962, 63.
Jeez.
When I thought of the Peace Corps, I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Latin America and I'll learn Spanish and I'll learn about American literature in a broader sense than just...
The Americas literature.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And understand the American experience from... their perspective too, and that will be something I can bring back to the study of American English literature.
Sounds wonderful, yeah.
And so I went through the process, and also about that time, Kennedy died. And
okay, so you're getting up to 63, sure.
Yeah.
And that's a blow.
I can remember being very moved by his rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
And So those two things, and especially because my father had died a few years before, so when this death moved me, it sort of resonated with something that was already there. And so I felt that...
Because you were still grieving for your father?
Well, yeah, probably, yeah. So my brothers and sisters were in school, and I didn't have any financial responsibilities there. Although I was helping my mother, what I was helping her with as a graduate student, I could help her as a Peace Corps volunteer.
Maybe better.
Yes. It was better.
Yeah.
And I just had school loans to pay off and stuff like that.
But they could get deferred.
They can get deferred, and also you have the readjustment allowance in the Peace Corps, which can be used, which could be used to pay off loans.
Yeah,
to,
whopping $1,500.
Yeah. So I was having applied for South America. I was assigned to West Africa.
Yeah. I told you my story already, so we won't put it again on the tape.
Yeah. So I decided to go. I decided to be exciting.
Still, and so you were still going to go to West Africa.
So I accepted the offer to go to West Africa. And I went to Eastern Nigeria with the Igbo people, who later declared independence as Biafra,
uh-huh.
3 years later. I was in a teacher training college with no education background. I did supervise some practical teaching, but the system there is so different that you don't need just the experience of having gone through the American education system. Has given a person a lot of understanding about education that the external examination-based system doesn't have. So basically, under the West African system, you're a coach for students trying to memorize material or somehow master material for examinations that come out of London. But I had students who were adults who were experienced teachers who were coming back to school to upgrade their certification.
Well, that's better.
And one Christmas vacation, we had a 45-day break there. I traveled to a different town each day. I traveled to 45 different towns. I visited 63 different students in their homes, mm-hmm. and I had incredible. I went to villages that had never seen a white man before, where people fled screaming
when they saw you. The evil spirits have arrived.
So I had a good time there, and I got my first taste of revolution
mm-hmm.
and war. There were some military maneuvers in our village, national maneuvers. It turned out one of my students was arrested. They thought he was a soldier from the other side of the game
mm-hmm.
who was spying and disguising himself as a student, but was obviously too old to be a student, not realizing the students in that area were adults. But I learned later that there was almost a coup during those maneuvers.
Oh.
And then there were the massacres in the north and Declaration of Independence. And one night we were returning from the village to the city in an IBS Jeep, and we were speeding into Enugu with the Minister of Rural Development in our Jeep
mm-hmm.
sitting up front, and a black American driving, two whites, males, and a white woman in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And between the time the minister had left the city and the time he went back late at night, around 11 o'clock at night, the military had set up a roadblock because they expected an invasion from the west
uh-huh.
led by British troops working with Nigerians. So when we came speeding along,
they thought
they were,
you were
sure
them.
We were the front guard of, and they had guns at our heads and everything. It worked out fine, but it was my first taste of what
could happen wrong.
What happens in the third world a lot.
You said this was an IBS Jeep?
No, I'm sorry, Peace Corps.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah.
Yeah. No, correct me, because I'm gonna make a lot of, I'll make mistakes like that.
Well, that's why I am really listening.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, truly.
So, I heard about IVS when I was in the Peace Corps.
Oh, really?
And I was disturbed by the war. in Vietnam, I knew what war could be like because in Nigeria, about 2,000 Igbos were massacred in the north, and they sent the bodies back in freight cars, mutilated bodies in the east. And I wasn't there when they arrived, but I was, I was there at the I was in the area at the time, and I was very much aware. And I saw refugees that came back who were swollen all over their bodies from mosquito bites from having hidden in the forest for a few days. One of the Protestant pastors that returned from the north had told stories of how he had been rescued by Anglican clergymen who had formed a convoy of about 7 Land Rovers and had hidden him underneath and driven him to the international airport and surrounded him to get him on a flight to Western Nigeria. And he had seen people being taken off of international flights and slaughtered with machetes in an international airport, just something like Logan. It was so it was a. So I had a sense of horror of war and so forth. So when I as I read about Vietnam and I learned about IVS, I thought I would like to go there and sort of model a different way to compete with a different ideology for high ground, other than, because I my feeling was that ultimately that's how you win anyway, by seizing the high ground, not the low ground. And so that was
as opposed to just outgunning,
right? I mean, you might have sort of a pyrrhic victory where you destroy others, but you've only built up ultimately more resistance, or just as opposed to winning others by reaching out to them, by finding higher common ground, or by some other having a moral victory.
Okay, let me get the dates right. I think I do, but you were in education, your own personal education, until 23. So that would have been about 1963, at the time of Kennedy's death. And that got you motivated to go into Peace Corps, what, in 63?
64. September 64, I trained at Barnard College. And
so you served really from
64 to
the end of 64 to through
June of 67. June of 60. Let's see, I started. I started at the Peace Corps. I mean, I started at IVS in September of 68, so maybe I finished up in the Peace Corps in June of 68, because I wasn't home long.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know,
just enough to touch down for a little bit, and then away.
So, right.
So all of 65, all of 67.
65, 66, 67, so maybe it was 3 years and a bit.
You did 3 years, so you did
regular
2 years. I did
3 years,
and then an additional extension of a year.
Yes, yeah, I did an extension.
And you still wanted to continue voluntary services.
Right, I definitely wanted to do field work, I wanted to do volunteer work, I didn't want to be in administration, because I felt those people were out of touch, not for any personal reason, but because of the structure, where they put themselves in the structure, they were out of touch. And what was really happening was happening at the field level, and I found that very exciting.
Yeah.
Also, I was involved in my village. Well, I did teaching, but I also got involved in economic cooperatives. I helped the villagers resuscitate a plan to build a maternity home It was, they had started some cinder block construction, and it was overgrown, and they'd given up. And I got AID funds. It was the first direct funding from the United States government to a village project without going through the Nigerian government that had been done. It was sort of an experiment between the two governments where the U.S. would fund projects directly.
Uh-huh. Not go through the...
Uh-huh. I mean, they had sort of a broad agreement, guidelines. Yeah. They had agreed on guidelines.
Of course.
But not project by project. Didn't have to go through the bureaucracy.
Mm.
And that was impressive. And that was... We built a...
So, actually, the administrators, even if they weren't in touch with the local things, they had some vision, too, that they wanted to avoid the government and get down to the bottom level.
Right. That was at a fairly high level. That wasn't local administrators. That was somebody at this level of the State Department.
That's impressive, though.
Because Americans were very worried about that. There was the ugly American, and they were trying to fight that image of insensitivity to people's needs and so forth. We'd also revitalized a market, which was another moribund project they had.
Uh-huh.
And I had also gotten involved in extending a water supply from one village to another. And the village whose water supply I was extending was unhappy because the chief school teacher in that village had been in love with a woman 30 years before whom a wealthy chief in the village that needed water had won away. And there was animosity due to that, and they didn't want to share their water. And the Peace Corps, in fact, was going to pull me out of there. And the Minister of Rural Development said, no, leave him in there. This is a good project, and we're going to make it work. And he was prepared to even send troops there to protect the water supply. And that may sound bad, but when I first arrived in the village, there had been a land battle with the neighboring village. And several people had been killed and had just been buried when I arrived there.
Uh-huh.
And it only took 3 Nigerian policemen to keep the two villages apart. The Nigerian policemen lived in the sort of no man's land, separated, and just had little huts there.
Mm-hmm.
And Nigerian police were very highly respected in the Congo. The actual troops that were sent to the Congo were the police. Nigerian police and not the military. So it wasn't that they would send people out there to sort of bludgeon the villagers. It would be more they would send people out there whom the villagers would respect as an authority on what was...
And show their presence.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Yeah.
And the funny thing was when I left, the villagers, as I was leaving, the villagers, the elders called me to their usual meeting place, which was the primary school.
Uh-huh.
And they gave me a wooden statue called an Ikenga. And it's sort of like a god. You would kill chickens to it and so forth. But they gave it to me as a gift.
Uh-huh.
Because I was practicing Protestant in a Catholic area. In one hand, it was a human figure. With one hand, it was holding a human head.
Uh-huh.
In the other hand, it had a raised machete. And it had filed teeth of a warrior. And they said they were giving me that because they thought I was a brave person. And meaning by brave, they thought I had moral courage. They were saying, in effect, I was right and they were wrong.
Uh-huh.
And they respected me for being right, which is a wonderful thing about the wisdom of elders. I mean, I was just really impressed with that. And they said they would have given me a big send-off with the public one with the whole village, but they just couldn't because of this water project, but they still wanted to thank me and so forth. And I don't think I've seen that anyplace else in the world. You know, that kind of moral... I mean, they were praising me for my moral courage, but they really had moral courage
as well
to do that.
Sure.
And to display it and recognize it in others is something you don't see very often anyplace.
Very, very rare.
So I left there really excited for more.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I can almost think of dozens of questions to ask you as an ex-volunteer, but, you know, that's too bad, but it's part of the lead up to IVS. I mean, most people are usually tapped out after 3 years, and you just got it going again.
Yeah.
So you heard about IVS while you were in Peace Corps.
Yes, in a Peace Corps magazine of some sort, and there was an address. I had also written to church addresses because I'd been active in the church and volunteered. But
which church? They, is
it? Episcopal Church.
Episcopal. Okay. And you were raised in that.
Right, I was raised in that, and I had gone to church in a nearby village at a cashew plantation. Uh-huh. I'd gone to church with cashew workers, and the medic at the cashew factory was a lay leader, and we just worked in a shelling area.
Uh-huh.
And we later built a church on my allowance, because I only needed $10 a month to live off the local economy, so the other 190 or whatever I contributed, and after a few months that was enough to start building
the church.
It also functioned as a primary school. And then I got some money through St. Thomas Church in New York City to help a chief in a Protestant village a number of miles farther inland build a church, and that money was delivered after I left, but I heard that it was delivered and so forth. And then the last thing I did, there was a little girl in the village who had a hair lip, cleft nose, her tip of her nose was missing, and you could just see inside the lining
really
and so forth.
Serious.
Serious.
Yeah.
And Peace Corps doctor had come, had brought a friend to visit me one day because he wanted to see a village. And this little girl had gorgeous eyes. She was about 4 years old when I was there. Beautiful eyes. And she just came and stood and looked at us while we were all chatting. And he noticed the visiting doctor, who was an orthopedic surgeon, noticed her situation.
Noticed, yeah.
But he noticed it particularly because he had had one himself.
Oh, that severe.
Yeah, not that severe.
Well, but see, okay. But
he had a cleft palate and a narrow lip.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days later, I got a proposal saying that if I could get her airfare, and I had spent quite a bit of money and time trying to have her cleft palate fixed, because a deformity is considered an ill omen there. And they used to put deformed infants in jars and just leave them out in the forest, but her parents had kept her, and but her prospects weren't great with a deformity like that. And I had made friends with a surgeon who'd been trained in Boston in Enugu, and he'd tried two or three times, but he said she really needed to be built up nutritionally, and they just didn't have the antibiotics and things like that to do. It just didn't take.
Yeah.
So this doctor heard the story, and he said, well, I'll make arrangements in the States if you can get her there. So what happened was the Rotary Club in the capital got her transportation, got her little suitcase. I mean, she probably wasn't wearing anything when the doctor had seen. She probably didn't have anything except maybe a ragged little shirt, the color of the soil that she would put on special occasions. But she had a little suitcase and a pair of red shoes and a dress and a hat and a coat and all these things. And so I got arranged for her papers, and she was going to leave with me. But because I was evacuated, I couldn't take her with me. So when I was in Lagos, which was the capital of Nigeria, on the way out, I stopped at the embassy and told them about it. And in fact, a Peace Corps volunteer who was evacuated after me brought her out a few days later. And so I took her to Newington Hospital for Crippled Children.
Uh-huh.
She went there. She was there for 2 years during the war, and uh-huh. I went to Laos.
Uh-huh.
And she, the operation, they took her lower lip and put it up and sewed it, and she was a perfect patient. They loved her. She, they cut her a new lip and so forth. And she couldn't go back, so they let her live at the hospital. And she had the run of the hospital, and she would go in and visit people. And so after 2 years, the Peace Corps decided to send her to Lagos, to an orphanage.
Uh-huh.
And they did. And when the war in Biafra ended, I got a letter from friends there, I was still in Laos, saying that saying that the war was over, her parents were alive, and everyone was wondering how she was doing. And so I wrote the orphanage, said the war was over, these are her parents' names, and
please reunite her.
And they wrote back and said they were so glad I had written because they had lost her papers and had no idea who she was.
Oh.
But she was a wonderful girl and had helped take care of the other kids in the orphanage.
Uh-huh.
And they'd be sad to see her go. So she went home, and she's a nurse's aide or something now. We still keep in touch occasionally.
Isn't that excellent?
So, I mean, that's going even beyond IBS, but...
See, I assume this is probably now around on another time. Well, I didn't. You see, there was nowhere on here for. I don't think you ever mentioned that you had been in Peace Corps. So anyway,
probably hadn't.
Probably hadn't. So this was like a real surprise to me that, you know, anyway.
So when you,
let me ask you. You know, do you have the Peace Corps experience? What immediately impressed you as some of the differences that you obviously noticed between the Peace Corps and this new organization you've now joined? Positive and negative.
Well, let me just make one more comment.
Oh, sure, of course, I'm sorry.
One reason I moved on to IBS was I didn't want to go back to school. And the reason I didn't want to go back to school was that my experience in Africa
uh-huh.
had introduced me to an incredible world of English literature written in English by people who were not British or American.
Uh-huh.
And I was so angry that no one had ever told me about this.
Because they didn't care about it.
Hinneman Publishers had a bookshelf.
Uh-huh.
And you start reading those and you finish one book, you want to grab the next one.
Uh-huh.
And it's such a world. It opens, I mean, and I can see the reason. Missionaries would come there from Ireland, or mostly from Ireland, with PhDs, and would be teaching kids in elementary or high school. Some of the Nigerian kids, especially the ones who were fortunate, had mm-hmm. incredible teachers.
Yeah.
And they brought out incredible talent. And so I felt, just even from the point of view of literature, I was learning more the farther I got away from school. I mean, I'm sure schools address these subjects better now, but...
a little bit better, but not as much as it should be.
Yeah. But it's... When you enter that world, it's breathtaking.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
So,
But I'm curious about the difference that you saw. Because
I had terrific training. I went to Barnard College, and one of the trainers...
This is for IBS.
For Peace Corps.
Okay.
One of the trainers
That's right, I'm sorry.
A blind Jamaican, middle-aged Jamaican professor.
Uh-huh.
Who knew African literature had an incredible knowledge of African literature. Mm-hmm. And here he was blind, and he knew it only from reading, having it read to him. So I had had really good Peace Corps training. When I went to IVS, it wasn't much different than that. I mean, the group was, it was smaller.
Yeah.
But it, but we still had, it was similar. It was obviously high quality.
This was in 1968 now.
Right.
Yeah.
And we went to Washington, and we went to Harper's Ferry, and we had an orientation. And there, people said to me, I originally volunteered for Vietnam. I don't think I had heard of Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, we really need people for Laos because we have
enough
for Vietnam.
And you say, I
want
to go to Southeast Asia.
They started telling me about Laos, you know, how it was far less developed and so forth and so on. And they made it sound, I mean, the more they said about it, the more I wanted to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going to Laos. And we trained in the Philippines, the International Rice Institute, Research Institute, which is, you know, I couldn't imagine getting better training.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, IVS and the Peace Corps, it matched the quality of Peace Corps. And it was about the same size group. It was because there were, it was a large group that went to Vietnam and Laos. There were probably 20 of us in our group, and maybe at the in the Peace Corps group there had been 40.
Uh-huh.
But but Peace Corps in Nigeria, there had been 700, and the top administrator was somebody who'd been a lawyer for many years. I mean, there was a little, whereas in Laos the top administrator was somebody who was a few years older than I was, or maybe even about my age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because
you already
so that
had
was
a few
little,
years under your belt
yeah,
beyond. Yeah.
Right. So that was a little different, and that was nice. But of course, in Laos, then the program was more structured. Well, I mean, it was structured by the demands of the war and so forth. And,
yeah.
So you felt the presence of adult, you felt adult leadership presence, even though IVS itself had much younger and less experienced leadership.
Okay.
When I went to Laos, I knew I wanted to learn the language.
Uh-huh.
I knew I wanted to live in the village.
Mm-hmm.
As in Africa, I wanted to live with a family. I didn't want to live alone. I had started off living alone in Africa, but then I had lived with a family, and that was just so great for me to.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did it do for you?
Well, one, I...
especially compared to your other IVS volunteer colleagues at the same time.
Well, for one thing, it completely changes your lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
So instead of living out of the commissary with peanut butter and so forth, Bisquick being flown up on an airplane, you get it weekly, and you, you know, you have your little IVS house, and you have your kitchen, and you have your houseboy, and you know, you're sort of living in isolation. Instead, I'm sitting in the village. I was sort of eating alone, but there was an older man in the family. There were people sort of my age and married with kids, and then there were younger kids, and there was a whole family hierarchy, and I would be sitting at a little table with some other people trying to struggle to figure out how to eat the soup, which include river shrimp, snails, insects, and all sorts of other things. And I, you know, I'd have to figure out how to suck the snails, and but I got a much better diet. and much
than peanut butter and Bisquick.
Yeah, and the food is just incredibly tasty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even today when you go and get fresh vegetables at Star yeah. Market or something like that, they're not like vegetables that have just been picked from the garden. But in the village, they go out when they need, in Lao village, when they need vegetables, they go out in the evening, and it's mostly vegetables and greens are mostly food gathering. There's very little gardening.
Mm-hmm.
They even pick stuff from the river, river plants that grow on rocks and things like that. So everything has an incredibly good taste. It's just, so that's a real secret that you, secret joy that you don't know until you experience. And then just the learning to see how people can cope with nature. I mean, it must have taken thousands of years for them mm-hmm. to learn how to make the river weed dishes and the mushroom dishes and what to eat, what not to eat. And there's just so much involved in the diet that that implies knowledge that I didn't have, that I could just imagine would take me an awful long time to learn, that it gives you a sense of how much natural knowledge of nature and so
mm-hmm,
forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me a sense of, and also, so it gave me that sense of a place in nature, a sense of how to deal with nature, a sense of how much more we have to learn about our role in nature, because our role through the technology is changing so much.
Uh-huh.
And we can we don't even appreciate the, we don't have time to appreciate the things we have because things change so much. And so just the insight that there is much more,
uh-huh.
there can be much more behind what's obvious than there seems to be is good. A hierarchy of relationships, the sense of being in a familial hierarchy that was far more extended than any I'd ever been in before.
Uh-huh.
That was the sense of being, one thing, just a sense of the war, the reality of the war. When I first went there, the old man gave me a rifle to protect myself. And I slept in a room that was sort of away from the house a little bit. And Lao houses are up, and traditionally the way someone's assassinated is they go under the house and shoot up through the floor. And a couple of IVSers were killed that way. But so they put me separate.
Did you know who they were?
I couldn't recall their names now.
Okay.
But when I went to Hong Sa, one of the people who left that village... because of the, it had just been attacked. I went there 2 weeks after it had been attacked, and the people who were there wanted to get out.
Uh-huh.
And I went there because I thought, I'll live in the village, and this is what I want. I want to be in a situation where there is conflict, so I can, because I want to see how the things that volunteers do interplays with conflictual
mm-hmm.
situations.
Right.
But he was later killed himself in another place.
Mm.
But he gave me a French Mauser rifle, which is sort of like...
This is the old man now.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's sort of like a Springfield rifle. It's
yeah.
very long, very heavy, it's bolt action, and three bullets. He gave me three bullets. and I learned later that many of the Lao soldiers had carbines of the kind that were used in the Korean War, which, as a young boy, I had followed through.
Uh-huh.
I had been interested in. I was about 11, and then you see the weapons that would occasionally be captured from the communists. You see the AK-47s and all the modern weapons, and you just realized what an incredible military disadvantage the Lao were at.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, Those are some of the kinds of things that one of the first days out, I was just sort of wandering around the village. I adopted the Lao dress, which was sort of balloon-like pantaloons that goes down just below the knees, which are very airy and prevent things like crotch rot and so on.
Yeah.
And I saw a farmer unloading firewood from an elephant, and he, although I barely spoke any Lao then, I'd memorized a few dialogues. He invited me to go with him to the forest to get more wood, and I rode on an elephant, and he ran beside it and made it gallop. And, and in addition to elephants being able to go fast, they're incredibly agile, because we went up the side of a mountain that I would expect only a goat to be able to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
And the elephant just had no trouble, and we went up, and the farmer loaded firewood up to me and things like that. So that kind of thing, experience that I never would have gotten living out of the IVS house. And I got it because of my Peace Corps experience. I knew it was there because of the Peace Corps experience. I didn't know what form it would take.
But you know that if you went out to meet it halfway, it would reach out and grab you and envelop you. Yeah. How did you feel? I thought about this before. You know, but I didn't want to interrupt until now because, you know, you were on that wonderful roll. But here you are, an English lit major who continues that sort of thing in Peace Corps, pretty much. Now you're being shifted over to agriculture.
Well, I had shifted in the Peace Corps because after 2 years at the teacher training college, then the third year, I wanted to move into the village.
Yeah.
And the Irish priest who was in charge of the teacher training college, an older man, thought I shouldn't move into the village because I might get involved with some village girls.
Good.
And
you never can tell.
So so he went to the extent of saying he didn't want me back at the college if I moved into the village.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Ministry of Rural Development, the Peace Corps, thought I had good reasons for wanting to move into the village. I'd done some research, and I'd traveled in villages, and I'd talked to the chief and so forth. So I and I was already involved in the maternity home and the market construction. So I also so they also connected me to an economic cooperative, organizing farmers' economic cooperatives.
Okay. So you're getting far beyond the English composition classes and all of that sort of stuff.
Right.
And so what IVS was asking you to do was not all that much more.
Right. I helped introduce short palm trees, short, highly productive palm trees.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have to climb. The fruit was all clustered near the
ground. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you were already doing the same sort of high yielding varieties of rice, but just in palm trees, and now it's going to be a different crop.
Right.
You know that you can do this.
Right.
You don't have to be an Iowa farm kid.
Yeah. And you'll see from my report, I was into it. And
very much
also
into it.
You'll
the
see,
double cropping and all of this
stuff. And it's sort of being a presence, being the eyes and ears, both for the farmers and for farmers and school construction people and the mayor, just being a liaison, sort of a middle person that helps out and facilitates communication and so forth.
Okay, I understand perfectly, but it did seem without that transition we just went back to that this is really an amazing leap.
Yeah, it's all in my head, but I did jump over it.
I just want to draw it out, that's all. But it's okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt because you were going on then to something else.
Well, following my experience in Africa, I wanted to get outside the village. I never wanted to travel to Thailand or Malaysia or see other oriental countries. But I wanted to travel outside my
village
to the other villages, to
and
mountain
that was
villages.
So you wanted to get beyond Paksa?
Hongsa.
Hongsa, I'm sorry.
Hongsa. And,
I thought there was another one, Paksa, wasn't there? Paksa.
Paksa was a city in the south.
That's right. That's what I'm confusing it with. Okay.
Hongsa is a small, isolated valley in northern Laos, just where the Mekong River flows from the west to the east.
It
flows
on the way to Luang Prabang.
To Luang Prabang. Okay. It's about halfway that distance between. Okay. It's about 12 kilometers as the crow flies from the river through some mountains to a valley.
To the south of the river.
Right.
Okay.
To the south of the river. And AID built a 24-kilometer road, dirt road, through those mountains to the river. They brought tractors in on barges, and they were going to grow rice in the village that was going to be sold in the royal capital. And this valley, this huge valley, was going to feed the royal capital.
That sort of makes sense.
And as soon as the road was finished, the communists let them finish the road. Yeah. As soon as the road was finished,
they took it over.
They closed it.
Yeah.
And they said, don't even bother to take your tractors out. Leave them here. And so they, the Air Force had to help them get the tractors out. Now, the Air Force consisted of single-engine propeller driven training planes.
This is the Lao Air Force.
That you could bring down, if you were good, with a spear, if they flew low enough. Three of those helped get some of the tractors out to the river.
Oh, dear. And meanwhile, you're in the valley.
So the project had basically failed.
Uh-huh.
So here we were in the valley. Thai engineer had come in and had shown the villagers how to build rock dams with, he'd brought in wire mesh to put over the rocks to dam up rivers, and he'd brought some dynamite, and he done a terrific job of working with the villagers to do dry season irrigation. There was plenty of water in the valley.
Uh-huh.
And he figured out how to get it in the paddies to grow the rice.
Okay.
Beautiful idea, beautifully executed. The rice left something to be desired in terms of taste. The Lao were spoiled.
By their sticky rice.
Rotten with a gourmet rice that required nothing except that you, while it's growing, you conduct your usual ceremonies, fix your farm, build your house, do all the things.
Let it do its thing.
You live your life, and while it lives its life, and then, the farmers got into this double cropping because dry season they wouldn't do much anyway except grow garlic. It's the main thing they do in the dry season.
Uh-huh.
So here this rice was growing, and the road was closed, and the village had been attacked once, we were sitting there and helping the farmers grow their rice, making sure they got their fertilizer. And one thing that did bother me was the use of insecticide.
Yeah, yeah.
The farmers were encouraged to use insecticide. Fertilizer and insecticide were brought in, and a big warehouse was built around them. They were piled up about 10 or 15
warehouse
feet.
Around them.
Yeah, they built a warehouse around them. Then, because these products, these crops required intensive care, were thought to require insecticide. And so that was distributed. Our farmers were told to get it. And with the warning that they shouldn't eat anything from the fields except the rice. Now the farmers live in the fields, and they live in the rivers that drain from the fields. So I
and
hope
the snails that you learned to suck on and to get out everything, and the fish that was in, everything is in there.
So I
the vegetables.
Hope that, I mean, I can't imagine after we left what happened to the insecticide that was there. I hope it wasn't used, but even if it's not used, eventually it's going to somehow get into the ecosystem there. If I ever went back, part of it would be a trip of conscience. About what happened. It would just, I don't think the farmers intuitively really believed anyone about. They probably stopped growing the high yield rice anyway after we left. They probably went to sticky rice, which doesn't need insecticide. It's impervious. And but I still don't know what happened with that. It worries me a little bit.
Although the one thing about the tropics is, this is true in Georgia too, the residual toxicity of insecticides breaks down, you know, very, very quickly.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. Oh. I mean, in the north, with a cooler climate, the toxicity remains longer.
Oh.
But because of the, you know, the higher temperatures and the longer growing periods, et cetera, the breakdown of the chemicals is faster.
Oh, well, that makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, if someone had ingested it very rapidly,
yeah,
of course, there's real problems. And I was working with some stuff. I'm going to pause this for a minute here, just so I can calm, you know. So,
I mean, there was so
I'll
much
put it
other
back
rice.
On again
yeah.
now.
And, there was so yeah. much regular rice being grown that the vulnerable rice from the International Rice Institute would not be singled out, you know, was not just sitting in the fields by itself.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of other rice there, too.
Of course, generally what happens with insects is that they would ignore the sticky rice because they can't get at it and concentrate on the one
right.
that they could.
Right.
So it might be a good way to draw them all together.
I did get out to some of the outlying villages. Matter of fact, I went to one mountain village, and while I was there, they were doing a farming experiment.
Oh,
they were
okay.
doing some double cropping, but they were a different ethnic group, different altitude, and...
what group were they?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
They probably would have called them the Kamu.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But
not to be confused
with the Khmer, right?
Or with the French philosopher.
Oh, yeah, right. we were walking with some farmers back from a field when everyone froze. They said, "Don't move." And someone came up with a bow and arrow and shot into a bush. And someone came up then with a big bamboo stick. And I saw something move in the bush.
Uh-huh.
And they swung the stick, and something moved again and started to move out of the bush. And they swung it again a couple of times, and it was a cobra.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And in Africa, I had seen a boa constrictor that was taller than a man that had been killed. They had given me a steak.
Uh-huh.
To take home and cook, because it was quite a prize. And so I said, "Oh, great." And they gave me a steak, the Kamu, villagers after they killed the cobra, they gave me a steak, and I took it home. And the Lao I was living with were horrified. They wouldn't
you
cook
savage.
It. Yeah, they said I was a savage. I said, "Oh, I eat this stuff." But the road was closed, and then at one point, Usaid said, "You know all that rice we're growing in your valley?" Yes, I am aware of all the rice, because I've been watching it grow since I came
here.
I've
been planting it and everything.
We don't think we can buy it,
because
we have no way of getting it out.
Oh. Which, of course, they've known for
that's
a long time.
That's nice. Would you like to come and pick me up and take me out of here before the farmers find out? But what we said was, you've got to buy it. I mean, there were agreements signed and everything. They had this thing called buffalo loans.
Mm.
Some farmers said they were too poor to grow rice in the dry season because they didn't have buffaloes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would lend some money to someone, and he would borrow a buffalo from his cousin,
uh-huh.
and then his cousin would take a loan to borrow the buffalo back from him. And all these farmers had buffalo loans, and they had to pay off their buffalo loans. with the rice.
And that was already contracted.
Yeah.
But so they depended on the AID
needed, if they wanted to get their loans back,
uh-huh.
The only way they could do it would be to buy the rice. I mean, they mm-hmm. couldn't expect the farmers to pay them back any other way. In addition, the farmers had invested a lot of time and so forth. It just wasn't good business to say, sorry, we're not going to buy your rice. So we said you either have to buy the rice or you have to take everyone out of here because our position is untenable. There's no reason for us to be here, and but we said that it would be, well, they realized it would be very bad not to buy the rice. So they scratched their heads, and they made a contract with the old man I was living with, who had a mill, to mill the rice,
uh-huh.
and we bagged it locally, uh-huh. and then these small planes, plywood planes, the Porter planes from Canada, backwoods planes, and short takeoff and landing planes,
uh-huh.
come in, and we'd load them up, and they would take this rice, and they dropped it to militia in the area north of us, and the militia were local troops
mm-hmm.
that were...
These were Lao?
Well, they are minorities, whatever the local people were in the area.
Okay.
But these were people who were likely to be engaged in, not in a frontline battle type of situation, but an occasional... They were people who were in areas where the communists were infiltrating, but not in sufficient strength to overrun an area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the rice was dropped to them.
Mm-hmm. To support them so that they could devote more time to their military duties so they wouldn't have to...
Right.
Yeah.
And they were... This was all run by the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
They were paid the same that Lao troops were paid,
mm-hmm.
but they were accountable. They had to do something. And also they were paid.
Yeah.
Lao troops were paid on paper, mm-hmm. but often not in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So
it would be better if you were a militia.
Except you were more likely to be involved in action, whereas the Royal Lao troops would be more garrison type duty.
There. I see that as a strong plus.
But everyone was sort of in situ. It was the troops that were involved in this under the CIA were troops who were in areas were. Natives of areas that were in
right.
contention.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
And most people in those areas would join one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't be neutral,
mm-hmm.
really. It was a way of surviving, was to join one side or the other.
How far were you from this?
I was on the other side of the Mekong River from this. I mean, occasionally they crossed over, like...
You're talking about when you meant north, you meant the other side of the river.
The
north,
other
not
side of
between
the river.
You and the river, but even
right.
much further
now,
beyond. Okay.
When I made these forays out to other villages, it seemed to me